This episode contains descriptions of violence and suicidal ideation. Listener discretion is advised.
Not like a butcher knife. We're just talking like your stereotypical chef knife.
Anthony Sukto spent his early life in Tillicum, Washington, and had a pretty typical childhood for the first 8 years of his life. What was your relationship like with your parents?
It was good. They were very loving and caring. They both worked full time. From what I can remember, my dad had always worked for Northwest Airlines when that was still a company. Specifically, I think he just worked on the tarmac. So I was always with my mom, and she was a chef. She worked at a Thai kitchen. So she would always bring me to work with her, and I would always just be in the back reading books, coloring, watching movies, and being a little kid. It was a pretty good childhood.
Both his parents, Tony and Prani Sukto, were immigrants from Thailand, and both social butterflies.
From what I could remember, my parents were pretty social. They had lots of friends in the Thai community. So from what I can remember, you know, there were lots of weekends when they would have parties and sing karaoke. I always got involved with that, you know.
What's your go-to?
Well, at the time, you know, it was a bunch of Thai music. So I was just reading lyrics on a screen the best I could. And more so it was just dancing and holding a microphone than actually singing. But it was cool. It was fun.
As an 8-year-old, Anthony wasn't super aware of his parents' marital problems. Prani filed for divorce in December of 2003, but didn't move forward with it. The couple was back together by February of 2004.
My memory from back then was pretty spotty, but it did seem like up until the incident happened, you know, they were kind of distant from each other. So I think it was at that time then my father was starting to get really heavy on, I think, meth. So once my mom was aware of that, she kind of wanted to make sure that, you know, we were safe.
Did your parents fight at all before?
If they did, you know, they tried very hard not to fight in front of me. Mm-hmm.
Were you ever afraid of your father?
No, not really. My dad, he, you know, tried to do his best to teach me everything that it is to be a kid living in America, you know, go to sports events, go out fishing, regular father-son activities, play catch, the whole nine. You know, is even more unfortunate because if it weren't for the drugs, then I feel like, you know, we would have had a pretty great relationship.
Do you know anything about the start of his drug use or how bad it had gotten?
The start, I can tell you, but I do remember being in the back of this truck. So underneath in the seat, you could, you know, pop it up. And there I saw, you know, a bolo, right? So it's just like a pipe and a bunch of pornography just sitting right there. And that's when I was like, oh, I started to figure things out a little bit and came to realize that, yeah, this is we're in a sticky situation here. But there wasn't anything that, there weren't any major situations or events that happened that led up, you know, that were like major indicators. I just felt like it was a high, super, super high one night and had some intrusive thoughts disguised as demons come into his head and acted upon him.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. Around 4 a.m. on October 22nd, 2004, Anthony was fast asleep when he was woken by his parents having an argument.
Do you remember, you know, just waking up in the middle of the night? And my dad was kind of just standing over the top of my mom and I. We were laying in bed, and it kind of seemed like they were already talking by the time I had woken up. And it wasn't very long before he had attacked her, and he was, you know, holding a kitchen knife. So I, of course, you know, just was in shock and had nothing to do but watch. So he eventually chased her around the house and cornered her, and eventually, you know, stabbed her to death. And
you saw it happen?
Oh yeah, I saw it happen. Crazy, obviously.
Yeah.
I didn't have any words. I know I remember my mother kind of screaming out to me, saying my name, and it was just screaming bloody murder, which, you know, just thinking about it, it's really tough to talk about. But after that, he had then realized, you know, that she wasn't, you know, moving or fighting, so he left her, and I was just across the room. So then, yeah, he turned to me, and he decided to have me get up and go into the other room where there was another bed laid down. And he started asking me some questions that I don't remember too many, but specifically just one question. And it was why I had bought, you know, my mom a set of knives across the street or somewhere. There was like a garage sale. In my head, I was thinking, yeah, she's a, you know, she's a chef, and kitchen knives are essential to a kitchen. So I didn't know what to say, but that was the only question before he kind of just like took the kitchen knife that he had in his hand, kind of like made like a chopping motion at my forehead, which is how I have that scar.
Mm-hmm.
I have another scar that is also on the same side, behind my left ear. He hit my forehead, probably turned, right? And then mm-hmm. he did it again, which is how I have this one. And then from there, he just went on to stab me. It went, I can't tell you how many times. More than five, for sure. Through my stomach, through and through. I had a lacerated liver. After he'd stopped, he kind of just walked around the room. I'm guessing just trying to assess the situation. And then he had walked out of the house, went into his truck, and then I started driving away. So after, you know, I'm just kind of laying there the whole time. I was still conscious, you know, even after he had stopped stabbing me, you know, I was still conscious. But so I kind of just laid there silent as I could, and trying to just play dead, right? And I kind of just had these thoughts in my head that, yeah, I was going to die. And I was saying goodbye to, you know, friends that I knew from school and family. And while I was kind of having these thoughts, another thought popped up in my head. What felt like just like another presence. I know in other interviews that I've said that they looked like angels. Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing that I had seen, when at the same time I had heard, you know, you're not done yet. I was laying there on my back, and they, it looked like three beings, giant, just silhouettes. And it was just for like a split second. I couldn't tell you vivid detail, but I felt like that was the presence that was there.
Do you still believe that they were angels, or do you have like a different interpretation of what happened?
I would like to still believe that they're angels. After moving in with my aunt and uncle, my uncle was Southern Baptist Christian. So, you know, studying the Bible and kind of just reassured me that what I had seen was, you know, it made sense based off of what is my new belief. Because growing up with my parents, they were Buddhist. So I had no clue, you know, what this thing was, or, you know, how to make sense of it. So yeah, I still believe it in my head. I know it's a traumatic event, and, you know, there could be a lot of skepticism behind that, but that's my faith, and, you know, I stand by it.
Anthony had to walk back to the room where his mom's body lay to get to the phone and call 911. Anthony told the 911 operator that his daddy had killed him with a knife and asked if they could please send the army men or an ambulance. But then, the call suddenly got disconnected.
I could see outside. I was like looking outside while I was on the phone, and I could see that he, you know, his truck had come back. I knew I had so much time to get back into place, but it was that he had parked across the street. So that did kind of give me enough time, because it was probably maybe a couple hundred feet, you know, from across the street and then to the house. So I had to put the phone back on the hook. Oh, I guess it was more of a stand, and, you know, drag myself back to the same spot that I was in, put myself in the same position. And I think he had came inside and kind of looked around and then just went back outside again.
Emergency services called back, and Anthony was able to pick up the phone again. Anthony didn't give them the correct address, so first responders were doing everything they could to find him.
They were actually kind of lost and confused, and they were asking that I would flicker the lights in the house on and off. I was able to do that. Next thing I know, I could see, you know, police lights and hear sirens outside. At that point, I just walked up to the front door, opened it, saw a bunch of flashing lights, and I think I just collapsed.
Police officer Mark Eakes was the first to approach Anthony.
And Mark was there as the first responder on scene. You know, he was the one that saw me as soon as I opened the door. Mm. You know, I don't know if you've seen those interviews, but he described it as, you know, the death stare. Just basically the look of death on a little kid's face, collapsing. I woke up probably just a few minutes later. I was on the sidewalk. They moved me onto the sidewalk to analyze my wounds. And next thing I know, we get, you know, into the EMT, and, you know, I'm passed out at that point.
Anthony's dad had actually flagged down the first responders from the front yard. He was apprehended immediately, and Anthony was rushed to the hospital. Paramedic Jeff Calhoun was with him in the ambulance.
I'm in the EMT going to the hospital. Jeff knows, he sees that my stab wounds were through and through, not on the surface, not just surface cuts. The knife went through my body, completely through. Once they got me into the ER, the doctor, surgeon, whoever was in charge of stitching me up was just going to stitch me up on the surface. Yeah, super scary, considering I had a lacerated liver and was bleeding to death.
Beyond that oversight, the surgery went well, and Anthony woke up in the hospital room with his aunt and uncle by his side. How did people like your aunt or any adult talk to you about what happened, like, while you were still in the hospital? So sort of like in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah. They just blamed it on the drugs. Like, your dad was, you know, smoking meth. He said he had seen some demons, and the demons told him to kill your mother and try to kill you too. And they didn't try to sugarcoat it in any way. I mean, they were also just as confused and mad about the whole situation. So I think at the time, it was just more so that they were very thankful that I was still living and breathing. And even though I'd asked the question, it almost felt like a rhetorical question, because I know why, you know. But you still ask why, because it's like so messed up.
Yeah.
But I knew why. It's just still, how does it even get to that point, you know? How does he start smoking meth? You know, why does he do that, you know? Those are the questions, I guess, that better to ask. But
yeah.
Still, I mean, it's just, drug addiction's a crazy, crazy thing.
Prani's sister, Nancy, and her husband were at the hospital when Anthony woke up.
I was always a very quiet kid, you know, being an only child. Yeah, I remember my aunt telling me all the time that, you know, I never really cried until after that happened. And then I would always cry, you know, crying for my mom or whatever. But
yeah, what's your mom?
Yeah, you know, they were just trying to be as comforting as possible. Obviously, you know, an 8-year-old kid, he's not gonna know everything about, you know, why, but they did the best they could to try to answer those questions and be supportive. And but yeah, it just felt like they were kind of betrayed.
Yeah, I just can't imagine how that was for your aunt, losing her sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's something that she's still struggling with. And it breaks my heart. Because I don't feel that she had gotten to that point of forgiveness of, you know, like myself. And it's almost like the way that she lost her sister, the way that she talks about it, it's like, I almost forget that she was my mom, you know? Mm-hmm. And she just felt so, so strongly about it. It's so tough to hear because she brings it up all the time at this point. It'll be like, hey, if you talk to your dad, you know, you should. And then flips the switch and just says, you know, I hate him. I want to kill him.
Anthony had to stay in the hospital for almost 6 months.
From what I remember, I mean, as soon as I had woken up, there was a bunch of stuff that was already just like gifts, you know, flowers, you know, my classmates, they kind of put together like a collage book. And it was just like a get well, you know. I had a really close friend. We were really super into Yu-Gi-Oh! And yeah, he gave me like some of his cards in there, like some of his, you know, most prized cards. And I was just like, oh man, this is really cool. And so, and I was also seeing a counselor. Fortunately, he didn't really get too much out of me at that time, but it was just more so just like kind of talking about it. And he would have me play with certain things. And I guess just wanted to make sure that I was on track to be okay. But it was nice, you know, being in the hospital. It felt, you know, I'm trying to recover. So that was tough, but
you felt taken care of.
Yeah, definitely. 100% taken care of. And that there was a lot of people out there that cared and had a lot of support.
Anthony also went on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
She did so much behind the scenes too, like outside of just having us on the show, you know, flew us out to Chicago, had to stay in a really sweet hotel, did all of these events, you know, tours, museums. But yeah, you know, Oprah was cool.
Two of the first responders, paramedic Jeff Calhoun and police officer Mark Eakes, took a special interest in Anthony.
Throughout the whole time of me healing, and they were always checking up on me and making sure I was okay. And even after I got out of the hospital, they were there. We would take tours of the fire department or the police station, or we'd go on ride-alongs. And they were just, they just loved me. And just wanted to be there for me. So they were just essentially a part of the family at this point, and they're like my dads.
I mean, it sounds like having sort of lost your nuclear family, that so many people came to fill in those gaps.
Yeah. Yeah. And more than I could even ask for. Like, this is, there's so many people. There's so many people, and it's so cool.
After Anthony was sufficiently healed and his aunt and uncle were officially granted custody, they took Anthony back to their home in Florida. Did you talk to the other kids about what happened?
I was very guarded about it when I was at that age. I always said it was a car accident. Mm. And anytime we would go to a swimming pool or the beach, I was wearing a t-shirt. So then it was just so easy to just say it was a car accident, and then that's it.
Yeah.
There's not really much to go about.
Is that how, if they asked about your mom, how you said she died in a car accident?
Mm-hmm. Yes, both, I would just say both of my parents passed away, actually. I wouldn't even talk about my dad being in prison. Yeah. I was just like, yeah, he's passed away too. And then I would actually talk about it. I would tell the truth to friends and kids that I felt were, you know, closer.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, growing up, in the age of the internet, kids all they had to do is just Google Anthony Sukto. And then that was a lot of the time too. And you know, he hooked you up on the internet, so I'm so sorry.
Growing into his teens, Anthony's feelings about what happened grew darker and darker.
It got to a point where, yeah, I was just so mad for no reason. And we were just at home living with my cousins at the time. Like I said, I'm very quiet. I keep to myself. So a really bad trait of mine is bottling up emotions, right? So eventually it's just going to explode. That was an exploding night. I just took a baseball bat and it was just sliding doors on my closet. And I just took the doors off the hinge and just broke it just to relieve some anger. And I mean, I have had, you know, and this was when I was younger in high school, like I did have suicidal thoughts. That was at a age in high school, but I haven't had anything like that at all. You know, sometimes I wonder if I, you know, how people would be if I just disappeared. But then I realized that a lot of people would be pretty miserable and devastated. Yeah. I'm sure. But yeah, that always brings me back.
Did you seek help for your suicidal thoughts?
No, I did not. That was something that I used my situation, right? I used that incident that night to kind of like snap myself back out of it. Like, hey, what the heck are you doing, man? Like, this happened already. Why do you want to just end it now after all of that for what it would amount to nothing, you know?
Yeah.
Would have been all in vain. So yeah, it still drives me, you know? I think about it and I'm like, man, a lot of people would say that, yeah, they wouldn't be able to handle that situation or handle life after the situation. And me being able to do what I do now, whatever it is, I should be able to do it diligently if I want to and succeed in some capacity.
Yeah, I'm all for, you know, living your life to the fullest. But I mean, just talking to you, I hope you don't feel like you have a responsibility to always be like the very best version of yourself because you almost died. Like, you're allowed to be a person.
Yeah, I know. I know we're not perfect. We're not perfect. But yeah, I mean, just like I'm my worst critic.
Other than that one counselor, did you ever seek other therapy or counseling, anything like that?
Had one in high school, junior, senior year.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, amazing woman, very gentle and kind. And so I was a little rebellious towards the end of my high school years, which caused me to leave. I thought I was big bad man, so I could just leave the house and just live on my own, just couch hopping. So I was doing that. And while I was doing that, by law in Texas, you're called McKinney Vento. You're a McKinney Vento student, right? You're a student that doesn't have a house or live at home or something. So they accommodate you with these regular things, just toothbrush, you know, sock, whatever, to be able to keep going to school. And also, I would be able to have a counselor and I could take one period to go see my counselor. And that went on, yeah, for I think it was at least once a week for the whole year. And it was great. Sometimes I didn't talk about anything other than just regular life. Sometimes we would deep dive. And I still have a contact. I'd love to reach out to her. I need to reach out to her and just tell her how much I'm thankful for her. And that was pretty much it. I never felt like I needed one or actually wanted one, just because of how much I had already talked about it within my youth group already.
Yeah.
And my youth pastor and my pastor. And so I was able to kind of just talk myself through my emotions and things like that already. But again, it was just another great opportunity to have someone in my life that was able to guide me. So I'm thankful for her too.
He did eventually move back in with his aunt and uncle, and Anthony credits two other things for helping him during his dark teen years: the Lord and hardcore music.
Wednesday nights after school, we had Bible study. So I was in a youth group with about 12 people. So we were studying. It was titled The Way of the Master. I was referring to Jesus Christ, right? And basically, we studied the way that he would teach. You know, you look at the Gospels and what he had said, what he would say and what he said. And it basically stems from just like the Ten Commandments. And what got to me was, you know, Jesus says, if you look upon another woman with lust and you've already cheated or committed adultery. And then obviously this one got to me was, you know, even if you hate and look upon your brother with hate, then you've already committed murder in your heart, right? So I'm looking at that like, oh, crap. I'm guilty. I am guilty. If I stood before a judge and the judge was God, he would say I'm guilty. I also listened to a song after that just to kind of put me at ease. Music has always been something like that for me. The song that I listened to is it's from a hardcore band.
Yes, when I think calming, I think hardcore.
Yeah, right. August Burns Red. The song is called Provision. You're listening to metal. It's just hardcore guitars and screaming, like you wouldn't be able to understand. But then I'm looking at these lyrics and I hear them. And it backed, you know, that lesson that we had learned in the way of the master that we were learning. The words say, you know, in the lyrics, I am the deceiver. I'm not getting any better. I'm the thief, the whore, the murderer. It's times like these, you forget to remember who you are. The way up is down. Truth is found when life throws you out and kicks you to the curb. And then these next two lines are like, killed me, broke down into tears. I'm just as much the problem as the man behind bars. He did with his business what I do in my heart. And then it goes into this nasty breakdown and I'm just like crying.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be jamming, but
I mean, yeah. Those are like, it feels like that was written for you.
Right. It really does. To really help pave the way to finding forgiveness for my father. And, you know, after I feel this conviction, I read these lyrics and I start to think, I'm like, man, it is really a lot easier just to not have any hate in your heart. It's like poison, you know, it affects everything else and how you see things and go about your way of life. And I didn't want to be like that. You know, I didn't want people to, you know, have conversation with me or interact with me and be able to tell that, oh yeah, that guy's been through some stuff. You know, the past is a part of me, but it's not who I am.
I mean, when I was doing my research and reading articles from, like, you know, the 10 years later or whatever, mm-hmm. I was like, this gets so well adjusted. I don't think I would be. I don't.
Yeah. It's not a, I mean, that's a pretty common reaction that I get. And again, I have to just attribute that to my faith and how my aunt and uncle raised me.
A few years ago, Anthony's aunt wanted to do a movie about the attack. It didn't work out, but the filmmakers asked Anthony to write a letter to his dad.
I typed up a letter, basically just told him, like, hey, yeah, I know you know that you've messed up. For a long time, I've had a lot of anger towards you, and as I should. But I've come to a point in my life now that I have forgiven you and I love you. I'm living my life as best as I can. You know, I have a girlfriend, I have a successful job, a career. And I hope that one day that once you get out that we can try to make amends and have a relationship, because that's something that I would, you know, would like before I die. He wrote back, and yeah, it was a very apologetic letter. I was very impressed with his penmanship. That was just the first thing. It looks like it's written in Thai, but it's English. It's very cool. Yeah, I don't know what my dad's been doing, but still was writing. So Man, I'm trying to remember this letter because there's just so much emotion behind
it. I'm sure.
And yeah, he was just very apologetic and he's very sorry. He's obviously glad and proud of, you know, the man that I've become. He also, you know, would like to continue writing and, you know, hearing more from me. But
did you write him back?
I have not. I have not written him back. I actually wanted to go see him. That was supposed to be the next step in this whole process, but the request got denied. And that's because of me being the victim. I'm not supposed to have any contact, but I'm sure if I really tried hard enough, there could be an exception that could be made.
Yeah.
It's based off of a conversation that I had with the chief of police, the sergeant up there. I don't know if it's, I'm a very bad procrastinator, I'll tell you that much. So things like this that, you know, obviously have a lot of weight to it. So bad at stuff like that.
Yeah, how do you feel about potentially seeing him again?
Oh my gosh, there would be so much going on. Feelings of joy and fear, right? I'd be happy that he's out. I'd be scared of, you know, seeing my dad again, just because the last time I saw him, he stabbed me. Fear of also, you know, now that he's out, you know, what's going to happen? Where's he going to go? Relief, because now, you know, he's out and I don't have to, I guess, just be restrained by the law to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, feels so many emotions, but I think overall I would be happy, because then it would be the start of a new chapter in my life and his life, I'm sure too.
Anthony's dad, Tony Sukto, was sentenced to nearly 28 years in prison. His sentence runs to 2032. Anthony no longer feels he has to lie about how he got his scars or what happened to his mom and dad. He uses his story to help people where he can.
How do you broach the subject with new people you meet if it comes up? Like, hey, where'd you get that scar?
Oh, yeah. It is so random. It happens just whenever I feel like it. You know, some people will ask, sure. And I'm like, do you really want to know? I'll warn them. I'm like, you're not prepared for, there's nothing that you could possibly imagine or think of to what I'm about to tell you. So then, you know, you have that conversation when it goes about it that way. How's mom and dad or whatever? And I'm like, well, don't have my mom, don't have my dad. Oh, well, what happened? Well, strap in, let me tell you. But most of the time, I always talk about it when I feel like it's an opportunity for me to help someone. And that happens all the time. Sometimes it's just something that I just come out and talk about when I feel like I have a connection with someone. At this point, it's not difficult for me to talk about it. It's just difficult for me to kind of deal with how people react to it, I guess, at this point. I'm okay with it. I've accepted it. It's brand new, breaking news to whoever I'm telling it to. So just kind of making sure that, you know, even when I'm telling my story, I make sure that I'm getting the point across that, hey, like, I understand this is where you're at in life and that's really tough. And I sympathize with you. And if there's anything I can do, let me know, because I've been in a pretty bad situation myself. So this is how I think you can go about it.
But if it's not in the context of you trying to help someone, if it's just like, whatever, but then the burden of the comfort is on you to comfort them hearing about this terrible story.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you have to be like, I'm so sorry to tell you this bad thing that happened to me.
Yeah. It's crazy, because then, yeah, you know, people just don't know what to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, you know what? Well, you know, it is what it is, and it's not like that's how you knew me, so it's just a thing that has happened. And to be able to do exactly this and share my story to those that have struggled, have survived, or are in that exact situation of trying to survive. It's really cool and humbling because it's nice to know there's not other, I'm not the only one, right? And unfortunately, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, there's still gonna continue to be more situations like this. So as long as I'm alive, and if there's anything that I can do to help, to be a voice, to stand up for domestic violence, and, you know, I'm all for it.
Today, Anthony lives in Pennsylvania with his girlfriend, Chelsea. He currently works at a car dealership, but would love to pursue a career in music engineering.
I graduated from the Conservatory of Recording Arts and Sciences in Tempe, Arizona, audio engineering school, great school. So as far as that goes, like, yeah, I would love to be able to just work on music, but unfortunately, I didn't find a really good opportunity that I thought was sufficient for what I needed. So I said, hey, you know what? I'm just going to rely on what I know I can do, which is just talk to people. And no, I enjoy the car business. I'm a finance director now, so I'm in management, and there's still room for me to grow.
Is there anything I forgot that, or we haven't talked about, that you want to make sure is in there?
Oh, if this ever pops up, and if he's listening, my man, Logic, I love that man's music. Seen him live like 3 times now. It would be cool to hear from him. Shout outs to him. Love his music. Peace, love, positivity, right?
To speak to someone at the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, call 988. The Lifeline is 24/7, free and confidential. You can also live chat with someone at 988lifeline.org. This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoy today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.